On a Monday, you're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring this hour of the pandemic as a partisan flashpoint. Public health workers are focused on expanding coronavirus testing. Governor Evers says the state can provide 85,000 COVID-19 tests per week. It's one of the benchmarks in his Badger bounce back plan, but that plan no longer has the force of law following a state Supreme Court ruling last week. So what happens if millions of Americans refuse to take tests? What do you do when people you order to isolate or to close their business, they refuse? These are questions that Keith Humphreys has been asking. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor at Stanford University. His piece in the Washington Post is called "Widespread Testing Might Not Work in America. We Love Our Freedom Too Much." Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Very happy to be on the show again.
So you're arguing that public health officials may not have the pulse on our true feelings about a national testing program that would be akin to, say, Germany or South Korea. What are you seeing?
Well, it's definitely true there are, the public health community is doing a lot of terrific work on the technical side of this, which, and there are enormous challenges there. How many tests do you need? Where do you deliver them? What are the antigens? What is the information system and all that? But then that still leaves us this political consent challenge of, will people actually do it? Because for this to work, there's no other way to do it but to have the government get bigger, to impinge on our autonomy, and to take a fair amount of our personal information. And they're, just as individuals differ on how comfortable they are with that, so do cultures. And we have a fairly libertarian culture among democracies. So my concern is that we'll work out all the technical details of it, but then not enough people will participate to make it actually effective to stop the virus.
I was looking at the news this morning, a number of protests against Germany's coronavirus policy and its restrictive measures, those protests taking place in Berlin over the weekend, Munich, Stuttgart. And so there seems to be some lockdown fatigue, not just here in the U.S., but in other parts of the world. What could that mean in terms of our frame of mind as we approach this pandemic?
That's a very good observation. There were also protests in Britain, and there's been resistance even in South Korea to some of these measures. So what that shows you is that some part of this is just basically human and understandable. You know, being restricted is no fun. You know, having things we enjoy taken away from us is no fun. So that part is going to be there no matter what you do. But if those sentiments are strong in a place like Germany, where the proportion of the population who says, I have confidence in the government and trust it, is about double the proportion who say that in the United States, you got to think anything that happens there is going to happen here on a grander scale. And I'm not just talking about, you know, people who show up with guns. I mean, that's a frightening prospect, but that's really a teeny part of the population. You know, you could still have a successful program with that small amount, you know, very strongly against it. But, you know, the challenge will be, what if the resistance is far more spread than that? Just a huge number of people do not want to, say, for example, not go to work because a health worker says you are on a bus today against next to someone who sneezed, according to our contact tracing, so you can't go work. And they say, well, I got to feed my family, so that's too bad. I'm going anyway.
We're talking with Keith Humphreys, a psychiatry professor at Stanford. You can join in. Have you had to draw a tough line with family members about how or when they could interact with you or your loved ones? What's that been like? Do you work at a business where you have to enforce rules like you want people coming in wearing masks or staying 6 feet apart? How have your customers responded? How have you communicated this type of social distancing and policies? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Keith, looking around the world, the app that was being used in Singapore on its tracing system, there's some other work in South Korea on an app. You were saying that, you know, some of these things would be flat out illegal under U.S. law.
Yeah, that's correct. So we have, you know, HIPAA in this country, which is an acronym for the law that, you know, protects health information. And of course, there are many reasons to protect health information that are in place in American law that don't exist in Singapore. And in South Korea, they do have privacy normally, but after the MERS outbreak, the government has the power in crises to override those privacy guidelines and get more access to personal information. That means things like, you know, knowing who has the virus, knowing if you're near someone else who has a virus, knowing where you've been and knowing who you've had contact with. And that kind of stuff, you can imagine lots of reasons people would have reservations about sharing that. So that's going to be a challenge here, you know, both the cultural level, but also just in the legal level. You know, people aren't allowed to go looking through your medical records typically. And there would have to be some workaround for that if we were really going to do this in the United States.
Let's take a call. Dave is joining us from Sussex this morning. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. My thought on it is, since the dawn of mankind, there's been viruses, there's been people getting sick and dying. People talk about beating the virus. You cannot beat the virus. The virus will not be beaten. The virus will take its toll on humanity, just like every other virus that ever existed in the history of the world. You either can fight it or you can't. And it's unfortunate, but it's part of life and living. You either fight it off or you don't. I believe that the entire coronavirus scare is just that. It's a scare, politically driven, because every other thing that the left has tried to get rid of this president with has failed. They invented collusion. They invented a way to impeach the president. It's failed. This is their last.
So, Dave, you're... attempt. Yeah, Dave...
Let me finish my thought. This is their last desperate attempt to get rid of this president and scaring the American people.
All right, Dave, I want to step in here because Keith Humphreys, I mean, you've looked at the perception that this virus is what it is. It's not, it's more, it's less of an issue and people are building it up to be something more.
So I appreciate Dave calling and I know other people feel the same way. How I think about these things is, in the end, it comes down to trust. Do you trust that when your government or a public health department or a scientist says this is a virus and here are the risks, that person is telling you the truth? And American trust in the national government is extremely low. It's been dropping. It's been, you know, it used to be 50 years ago it was higher, but really since the 70s, it's mostly been trending down, other than a brief jump up after 9/11. But now, if you ask Americans, do you trust the government to do the right thing all the time or most of the time, only 17% of Americans say yes. We also have a much more fractured media environment than we've had before. So different media networks will convey different information to people that conflicts, and people watch different channels, and so they get different sets of information, some of which is accurate, some of which is inaccurate. So in that environment, it gets very hard to persuade everybody to act together because they don't even agree on the basic fact of whether this is a threat or not, or how big a threat it is or not, or whether the steps being taken might work. I mean, that is really America right now.
Stanford Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences Professor Keith Humphreys is our guide as we look at how politics folds into this national health emergency. Are you having a hard time convincing your loved ones to follow your practices in the COVID-19 pandemic? Do you work at a business where you need to enforce rules? And how are people doing with the rules that you want them to follow? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Keith Humphreys right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the public health field's challenge in getting compliance to stop the spread of COVID-19. I was reading a social work professor at Ohio State who put it this way: it's important to remember we don't have control of others' behavior. It's okay to have an emotional reaction to seeing someone casually ignoring or actively violating recommendations aided at aimed at protecting the health of the public. But at the end of the day, we can't force anyone else to change. So will the American way and personal freedoms make it difficult to contain the disease? Keith Humphreys has been writing about this. He's a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor at Stanford, and he stays with us. So, Keith, are there socioeconomic differences between people who are on board with public health measures like contact tracing versus other parts of the population? Can you segment it out in any way?
Yeah, so far, there doesn't seem to be a big income gradient on this. So Greg Sargent at Washington Post published some survey data on this, and people in different income strata are about equally likely to say that the measures that have been taken so far are reasonable. They're about equally likely to say, for example, that, you know, they think wearing a mask is a good idea. So we don't see that split quite so much. I think it's going to be a complicated sort of split. It won't be as simple as rural-urban. It won't be as simple as red and blue state. There will be particular places in the country where there is a sense of trust. There's a fair amount of cohesion, a shared sense of usness, and they will do test, track, and isolate programs well. And just an example, like it might be Nashville, Tennessee seems to be doing well. I've heard good things about North Dakota. I think the area I live in, so the San Francisco area, will probably do pretty well. I've heard some good claims about Massachusetts. So it's not that it won't happen anywhere, but it's a virus and it's highly infectious. So having a few spots where we control it isn't enough because, whatever the more loose places where people don't want to do this, are going to spread virus to those other places sooner or later. So that's why it's, to me, still a question of whether or not we can get enough consent from the country for this to work on a national scale, which is different than it just working in one city or one state or one county.
Well, let's bring in Daryl now, who's joining us from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. Sure. My comment is, emotionally speaking, wearing a mask is really only showing other people that we the people respect and care for others, unlike our sitting president, who's only good at telling us his stories, keeping we the people on vacation in Egypt, swimming in the river of denial.
So, Daryl, let's look at mask wearing here for a moment, Keith. At the start of the pandemic, public health organizations like the CDC said that masks weren't necessary for protecting the general public. We saw that change. Do you think the mixed messaging around masks has altered people's trust in public health? And what does a person wearing a mask, what does that say?
I think it does. It does lower confidence, and I'll just be very honest. I've had the same struggle. I mean, I have very smart colleagues who study this, who come to different conclusions about mask wearing. I myself do wear one, but what was being reflected was, that the science on this is really complex because to figure out whether or not a mask matters, you also have to figure out whether everyone else is wearing one. And there's probably some point in the population where, if only a few people are doing it, it doesn't make a big deal. But if a huge number of people are doing it, like, say, in Japan, it may matter quite a bit. In science, I look at that and say, well, that's smart people looking at the evidence. It's complicated. There's not a simple answer. But to the outside, to the public, they may think, oh, these folks don't know what they're doing. They're just switching what they're saying every single day. And so I don't believe it. And, that's a real challenge. There's also just, I find this interesting, a cultural challenge about Americans and masks. My colleague, Jeannie Tsai, who's an eminent professor of cross-cultural psychology, has shown that Americans are particularly oriented to human smiles. We look more at the lower part of the face. We use smiles to judge who we trust and how we feel about them. And that makes us less comfortable with covering the lower part of our face with a mask than you see in certain East Asian cultures where people tend to attend more to the eyes and use that to make judgments about others.
We're talking with Keith Humphreys, Director for Mental Health Policy at Stanford University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. You can join in. Does guidance from public health experts have you confused about how to protect yourself against COVID-19? Do you wear a mask? Have you perhaps become a little more lax about precautions in recent days? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Donna now. joining us from Dodgeville this morning. Hi, Donna.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a nurse. I'm just getting off work right now. I work at St. Mary's Hospital in Madison. And, you know, we've been dealing with this COVID ever since it started. My philosophy on this is that mask wearing and perfect timing with the gentleman that was just talking, you can't make everybody do what needs to be done. So what you can do for yourself is to protect yourself. And hopefully there's going to be enough people protecting themselves by wearing that mask, doing the social distancing, washing your hands, because the guy next door to you or the guy that is in the grocery aisle next to you that doesn't have a mask on, at least you're protecting yourself, you know. And I can't believe that people aren't listening to science, but they won't if they don't understand it. And you can't make everybody understand what they don't want to understand. So,
Donna, thank you so much. And before we go back to Keith, how are you holding up as a nurse?
I got a calming app on my phone.
Okay.
because it's so frustrating. And it's not work that's frustrating. It's the population that's so frustrating. It's the conspiracy theories that are frustrating. People aren't using their knowledge to the best of their ability right now. And I understand that people are hurting, that people want to get back to work, and I totally understand that. But on the other side of that, I think that's where the federal government should come in and start doing a little bit more with helping out the people that actually need it.
Donna, go ahead.
I personally did not even get a stimulus check, but that's okay because I'm working, you know. Yeah. If it comes in the mail, I don't know if it's going to come in the mail, you know. And I'm working. I don't know about all those other people that aren't working that haven't gotten them.
Donna, thank you for sharing your situation. Thank you for your service. Keith, you know, Donna has a lot there to discuss, one being that she's trying to stay calm in all of this.
Yeah, it's an enormous challenge for everyone. It is perfectly understandable, even if you were not a heroic nurse on the front lines like Donna is. But anyone who is even sitting at home just looking at the news, it's frightening. People are dying. Illness is scary. Economic collapse is scary. People are losing their jobs. They're worried about feeding their families, paying the rent. There's a lot to be legitimately frightened about. And that has to be, managed on top of all these other things. And it affects our decision making. I mean, when we are scared, when we are anxious, we may not make other decisions as well as we otherwise would, like things like, do I wear a mask or not? Or how do I react to somebody who isn't wearing one? Or how scared does that make me? Or how do I react when someone in a supermarket says, hey, I'm wearing a mask, why aren't you? Do I go off on them? Or do I recognize it as a helping gesture or not? And there's really no way to separate that, because we can't stop feeling what we're feeling in the face of, so much death and so much economic pain.
Well, let's look at that supermarket interaction for a moment. What do you see happening there? Do you call someone out for getting too close in line, for not wearing a mask? What is that like?
So this is another interesting cultural difference. So in Japan and in Germany, one thing they have in common is people often do social pressure on each other on all kinds of things, like you didn't separate your recycling, you crossed against the traffic light, or you didn't wear a mask. And, sometimes it's just a look. Sometimes people say things, but it's just an accepted part of the culture that there's a lot of that, social pressure to, follow rules. Whereas in America, how do we tend to think of the people who do that? We think, oh, that's the busybody. Why don't they back off, mind their own business? I have a right to make my own decisions. And that's going to mean that those social processes that in other countries help them push, say, mass compliance up to really high levels, we're going to have a harder time achieving that, because that is just an uncommon thing to do in American culture, both put that pressure on, but then also to respond positively to it. That's less encoded in our cultural DNA.
We have Stanford psychiatry professor Keith Humphreys as our guide. How have you seen people push back against stay-at-home orders or even in the grocery store? What are you seeing? Why do you feel the way you feel? And what policies do you think would lead to better testing outcomes and compliance? Or is that out of reach considering American values and liberties? There's time to talk about this at 800-642-1234. We'll get back with Keith Humphreys right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A quick signpost here. WPR's reporters stationed around the state working to track developments, uncover stories, and provide data for you. You can find a hive of information at WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about what comes down to trust and compliance. Should we shoulder serious inconveniences and possible invasions of our health privacy in the name of public health? We're spending the hour on this question, hearing your thoughts. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor at Stanford, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Paul is joining us from Hudson this morning. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I have a comment. I'm very concerned. I lost a brother 3 weeks ago to the corona down to VA home in Iowa. And I know the seriousness of it. I had a situation the other day where I walked into an independent IDA grocery store, and none of the workers were wearing masks. And I turned around, I walked out, and I had a mask on. And I'm not wearing it. For me, I realized that I'm wearing it to protect people. And when I was walking out to my car, there was a delivery man in the delivering bread from a vendor. And he was coughing. He wasn't wearing a mask. And he was loading bread on to a cart to bring into the store. It concerns me very much because I live in Wisconsin. And let's just face it, a lot of the men think they're macho and they don't have to wear a mask. And we all know that it's coronavirus, because of the enzyme in men, attacks them worse than anybody else.
Well, Paul, I'm so sorry for your loss. Keith Humphreys, you know, Paul has felt the loss of COVID firsthand. He is seeing in public where, you know, people aren't wearing masks when he goes into the grocery store. And his perception may be drastically different now that COVID-19 has hit home for his family.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a common experience across the country. And, you know, I'm sad for what Paul has lost. It's impressive that that has seemed to translate for him into concern about other people. And that could happen more broadly. I mean, how a certain amount of people in rural areas look at this now is they see this as a city problem. It will never come here, so why should I change my behavior? But as the virus is working its way into more rural areas, more and more people are going to become exposed to it. And sadly, that means more people are going to experience suffering, either from being sick or from a loved one being sick, or, you know, in the worst case, losing someone that they love permanently to the disease. And that may alter their perception of it. That experience may be more salient than anything, you know, they've heard in the news or seen online about, you know, how deadly this virus can be.
Let's bring in Jim now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. And while I was waiting, I heard Lake Geneva mentioned on your news blurb.
Yeah, and I was thinking of you, Jim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I've got an education in science, and I'm a smart guy, but I think so anyway. I'm not a stable genius like our El Presidente, but I do look at reality, and it's terrible for people to catch this and be passing away. And Lake Geneva happens to have, I believe, the largest number of people in that county, in Walworth County, dying from it. And it's only two blocks away from their Walmart and all their big stores. It's incredible. And to look at this cold and hard, and I feel sorry for anybody that's affected by it, and I wear a mask every place because I'm susceptible. But one of the things I've done is people are wearing less masks. If I see them in the store being silly, I cough, you know, and that maybe wakes them up. That's one way of spreading the word, of get your head, you know, where it should be. And if nothing else, this epidemic is going to get worse. We know that. We have to stop listening to the power politicians that want all the freedoms but have no concern of our health. They're thinking about money, and yeah, that's important, but if you're not alive, you can't spend it or make it.
Well, Jim, thank you for that call. Keith Humphreys, a cough could be a scare. An accidental sneeze may have people scattering from you in a public place.
Yeah, it might. I mean, and that is one of the interesting dynamics here, is how much of this is about social signaling. So I have noticed that when I wear a mask and I go on a walk each day, that it other people seem to really be a bit jolted by seeing me with a mask if they don't have one on. And they may give me a little more social distancing, which in a sense is irrational, because if I have a mask on, the risk I pose to them is less. But it's a way of saying, you know, this is serious. And, you know, this, and there's risk here. And so that, you know, it can be, in that sense, there might be a tipping point where if enough people are doing that, enough people are wearing masks, people then, instead of being anxious of being the first or the second or the third person to wear a mask, they become more anxious about being the one person who isn't wearing a mask.
Let's take a moment to look at Sweden's approach to addressing COVID-19. Sweden has approached it with a bit of a lighter touch, keeping many schools open, allowing for larger gatherings. Do you see the U.S. on this trajectory?
More or less, I do, although we'd be different from them in the sense that they actually chose their policy. And we, I think, are just going to end up there by an inability to choose. You know, so there's enough. There are people who want to do a much tighter lockdown, much more rigorous test and tracing, and so on. And also lots of people who are against all those things. And so we sort of end up in as a Swedish system by default, with the exception that they have universal health care to catch the people who get sick, and we do not. So we could end up with, a worse situation than they have, because, we've adopted, we have the piece of the policy that may increase exposure, but not the pieces of their policy that makes it less likely that you will die if you get the infection.
Let's take Sandra now in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Sandra.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. In my opinion, I'd rather have some restrictions from normalcy than to be seriously ill or dead. The U.S. makes up 4.3% of the world's population, and we have 29% of the deaths from COVID-19. If people don't care about themselves, I can't understand why they don't care, about others, maybe older people and their families, or maybe people who are somewhat compromised. And I also wonder, what are people doing that they don't want contact tracing? Where are they going? Why would that hurt you to have someone know you went in this store or that store? And now we need to be aware of conspiracy theories. I have a neighbor who thinks the moon landing was staged, and I now wonder if he thinks this whole thing is a hoax.
Sandra, thank you for the call. Keith Humphreys, public health as an entity, public is everyone. It's not about private health, a personal individual's health. How do we approach that through the stages of this disease, and especially contact tracing that is more invasive of our privacy?
Yeah, so, it is, in many ways, I think it's worth saying that the valuation of human rights is a great thing about America, that we have freedom of speech, freedom to practice religion we want, or no religion, to assemble as we wish, and those have been part of what have made us a great country. But there is, in this situation, those same virtues start to become a liability, because there really isn't any way to be a go-it-alone libertarian in the face of a highly infectious virus. So it's exactly as the caller said, you know, you can't separate your interest from the interests of other people, including people you love, like, you know, your older relatives, or there's many people who are immune compromised of all ages. And so we're all in this together, like it or not. That's the way it is. What each of us does is going to have a profound effect on the people around us. And, you know, can we come to a point, and as the caller I thought very well said, is I'm willing to accept these constraints on individual liberty for this common good for now, not forever, but for now. And that's the debate we're having as a country. So far, I think we haven't come to consensus on that, and I'm not sure that we ever will.
Keith Humphrey is with us, psychiatry professor at Stanford. Let's go to Tim now in Elkhorn. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi.
I was concerned about Walworth County. We're not getting any reports since the 14th. Is that so maybe more people from Illinois come up this coming weekend? You know, I'd like to know why all of a sudden they took the whole weekend off to report their cases and keep us informed.
And so, Tim, you're seeing some flux there as you look at your county being close to the Illinois border. And, you know, Keith, what is it like for people then who decide to travel across border and go into a different state that has perhaps different stipulations, different orders in place about how they are addressing and attacking COVID-19?
So this is a really good example of why we are, in fact, all in this together. So the virus doesn't know what state borders are or county borders or city borders. It will just go wherever it wants to go. So if you have, you know, two states that are next to each other, two counties, two cities with radically different policies, unless you're somehow going to wall off that entire region, whatever is the more virus-friendly policy is the one that both of them are going to have, because people go back and forth all over the country. And that's why it's, you know, really critical that if we want to achieve these kinds of national initiatives, we have to agree on some shared standards. And we haven't done that.
Stanford psychiatry professor Keith Humphreys is our guide to this conversation on public health challenges and cultural beliefs. How do you want to see public officials changing their messaging, perhaps, about safety during the pandemic? Have you had to draw a line with family and friends because their reaction to the public health emergency is different than yours? How have those conversations gone down? Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute with Keith Humphreys here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Should a global public health emergency of this magnitude override concerns about individual privacy and autonomy? Will widespread testing and physical distancing work in America to contain the spread of COVID-19? It's questions we've been asking through the hour with Stanford psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor Keith Humphreys, who stays with us. So, you know, Keith, as we move forward here in this pandemic, what would you recommend people do to have more thoughtful conversations with others around them about taking safety precautions, how you broach those conversations with loved ones, with neighbors?
You know, the most helpful bit of clinical supervision I ever got from when I was taking care of patients was from a supervisor who said, you can say almost anything to another human being if they know that you care about them. So the most important thing always, I think, is to start with caring about people, not to call your uncle who refuses to do this a fool or question his sanity, but to say, you know, I care about you. I don't want you to become sick. I don't want you to die. I want you in my life. And that's why I'm asking you to, you know, take these measures so that I can, you know, keep you around and that we can share the love and connection that we've had in any years to come. And you'd be surprised when you start from a place of love, you can persuade people of things that you can't when you just come at them with an argument.
Do you think that they're able to see that when you express those emotions of feeling of love and respect for the other person? Will they reciprocate?
I often find that that's the case. I mean, not everybody can be persuaded. That's for sure true. But you just are more likely to get that conversation to go well if you start by, you know, expressing caring and expressing respect. And what happens a lot, and I think, you know, social media probably feeds this a fair amount, is people start with their attack, or they start with their dismissal, or they start with their insult. And that just makes people close their ears. So while you can't be sure of persuading somebody if you start with a more loving and respectful approach, it's clearly you're going to have a better shot than you are if you just come at them with, you know, a critique from a position of critiquing them or looking down on them. I just think that hardly ever changes people's views.
Let's bring in Stephanie now in Racine with thoughts on this. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am in Racine. I went down to Indiana to take care of my 98-year-old father this weekend, and I went to a store down there. I'd say 90% of them are wearing masks in Indiana. Up here, maybe 20% are, and in Racine, they won't follow the suggested shopping flow, and when I've suggested something, they practically spit, some of them. And I wouldn't mind if we all got tickets for not wearing a mask for a while.
Stephanie, may I ask, how is your 98-year-old father doing right now?
He's staying isolated, so he's doing quite well. I wore a mask the entire time I was in the house with him.
What does he say about this pandemic? Because he's been around, you know, he's been alive so many years.
He'd hear more about global warming, but he thinks that comes and goes. But he says that at first he took it very lightly, and once people started dying all around, he started taking it more seriously. He does think he would like to see the country open back up, and he would like to see everybody be cautious and everybody wear a mask.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing your story. Keith, you know, outside of the mask wearing, what do you see among older populations, the threat to them, and also perceptions of what could happen?
Well, you know, older people do have one advantage, which is they have memory. So, you know, one reason why places like Taiwan and Japan and South Korea and Singapore quickly adopted public health measures is everybody has a memory of the MERS and SARS outbreaks of, you know, recent years. Whereas in the United States, we haven't had an epidemic this bad probably since the late 1950s. But if you're older, you remember that. And that can help, you know, motivate people to realize, oh, this can get really, really bad. And for people, you know, even people my age, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, what a pandemic is like. I mean, each day brings new disbelief, and that can make us not act until it's too late. So something our elders can probably teach us is to, recall their past experiences when epidemics did shut down the entire country, when proportionally an enormous number of people died, and what that was like. And so I'd be very interested in hearing those stories from those who lived through those experiences.
Cynthia is with us from Nina. Hi, Cynthia. Are you there, Cynthia? No. Let's go to Michael now in Northwest Wisconsin. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I was listening to the program, and you were talking about the stay-at-home order. And the thought of, you know, people crossing state lines, county lines, what have you. And I just wanted to make an observation comment that I live up in Burnett County, Wisconsin, which is the northwest corner of the state, right on the Minnesota border. And for the last 2 months, since our stay-at-home order has been in place, we have a normal influx of Minnesota people who have a lot of cabins up in this area. It's a cabin-type area, lots of lakes. We have over 200 lakes in the county. Anyways, I have not seen any decrease in Minnesota activity. The first weekend May was our opening of fishing season. At least two-thirds of the vehicles that we saw were Minnesota people. So I have a problem with people saying that we don't dare open up anything because people are going to spread. Well, people have been here, like I said, for 2 months. You couldn't tell there was a stay-at-home order other than everything was closed except for the grocery stores.
Michael, thank you for that observation. And Keith Humphreys, as we spoke earlier, this virus knows no boundaries between state lines and county lines. But it's clear in Michael's observation that people are moving around. They're going to places that they care about, where they find a sense of home and community.
Yeah, and that's what we see in the data of, you know, when people track smartphones and look nationally. I mean, people sheltering in place seemed to peak a little over a month ago in the States, and people have been moving more and more. And because it's always the, you know, the more mobile, the person who takes fewer precautions, who's going to be the one who, you know, has more of an impact, including overriding other people who are taking more precautions. And that's why I think it's unlikely we're going to be able to mount a national comprehensive test, track, and isolate program that stops the virus.
Well, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have together, what are you tracking now in your research? What are you keeping an eye on?
I follow the mask literature very closely because an alternative mechanism, if we can't do the test, trace, and isolate, is just getting, you know, 80% of the population to wear masks. And, you know, the data is, you know, encouraging that that could cut infections a fair amount as long as we are careful with our masks, and meaning we, you know, we clean them regularly and don't touch them excessively. And, you know, like other people, I'm reading the vaccine research. I'm not a virologist. I do work with many of them. That's honestly a long shot that would happen quickly. It's an extremely challenging problem always to make a vaccine. But that, of course, would be a game changer that would help get around some of the cultural barriers we have in the United States against test, trace, and isolate, because, you know, some people would resist vaccines, but an awful lot of Americans would sign up for that.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor, director of mental health policy at Stanford University. And he had a recent piece in the Post, Washington Post, called "Widespread Testing Might Not Work in America. We Love Our Freedom Too Much." Just ahead, it's On Point. The U.S. economy could be headed for another Great Depression. On Point digs in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.